Before 250 years ago, for thousands and thousands of years, Andy, there was no poor people. There was no homelessness. There was no orphans. There was no prisons. And there was even no nursing homes. We had a strict law, a strict way of living. We looked after Mother Earth, each other. We did have conflicts, but they were very few and far between.
Beautiful. So I think a good way to start is, I definitely want to learn more from you. This is sort of, I want to start on like a clean plate. So roughly 3 to 4 years ago, I went to Uluru. I really wanted to check out, you know, Uluru and see it. It was like one of the bucket list items. And one of the main tourist attraction was, you know, climbing Uluru. Now, obviously, looking back, you know, I know that wasn't really, the Aboriginal culture didn't really like people climbing it. It was a huge attraction, and it was something, I don't know, I was younger and I really, really wanted to do it. Now, as I'm talking to you, I'm blushing. I'm feeling really bad. I'm saying this. I'm like, is Glex going to be angry at me? So I'm a bit scared, but I had to just take this off my plate.
No, Andy, because a lot of people didn't know, and that's what's happened within Australia with colonisation, that a lot of people don't understand our stories and understand our deep cultural values. But we can go further in that. But I think first off, I should introduce myself.
Yes, please.
My name's Lex Dadd. I'm a local Darug man within the Sydney region. I come from the Gunnamagal clan, which is near Prospect. There's 29 different clans within the Sydney Basin. I'm also married into Darawal country as well, and I have connections through other countries within Australia. Now, we have over 350 different countries in Australia and over 350 different languages. And traditionally, boundaries were respected. You didn't have to write that to come onto someone else's country uninvited. I just wanted to let you know. And we didn't give our sovereignty away or our titles, and there's been no agreement with the government now, and never has been, for the dispossession of our people and for the taking of our land. So for instance, if I give you an example, if I steal that microphone off you that you have on your lapel, how many years go by that it's okay that I've stolen something from you? It's never okay.
Yeah. It's never okay.
And just to clarify, to introducing myself, I've got Darug ancestry, English and Irish. And I can trace my heritage right back to the First Fleet and further, of course, within our Aboriginal culture. And I was very fortunate enough to grow up down in Yuin country down on the south coast and learned a lot when I was a young boy, bushcraft, etc. And that's what I do up here. I do welcome to countries, smoking ceremonies. I'm a wood carver. Like I said, we're filming this in the shed that I have at Wentworth Falls. It's a big old RFS shed, for instance. And we'll be doing woodwork here, weaving. We'll be having a dance circle here. Lots of community community activities here for not only our Indigenous kids, boys and girls, but also for the wider community, give them a better understanding of culture and what it means for us. So there you go, Andy, a bit of an introduction.
Thank you so much for the intro. I really appreciate it. I remember meeting you and I didn't know that you were an elder. I think in my mind, through, I don't know, TV, movies, I was always imagining sort of older, darker skinned Aboriginals with, you know, didgeridoos. And that's something that I was like, oh, wow, you're an elder.
So let me clarify that, Andy. I don't call myself an elder. And within our culture, we get taught to be patient, humble, and respectful. They're some of the first things you learn when you do first stage ceremonies. And so I don't call myself an elder. Other people do call me elder in the community. I call myself a senior Darug man. And when we get back to the colour of our skin, and this is only from what I talk about is only from what I've been taught. And I'm quite happy to sit around a fire and have a yarn with other black fellas and Indigenous mob around the world and discuss things, because you've got to remember a lot of our culture in Sydney was stolen from us. But yeah, I have pale skin. And when we mix with other races and nationalities, we take on their features within a few generations. But it doesn't change my connection to country and what I've been taught and part of my responsibilities for my country. But there'll be many people in Sydney that actually deny us, that deny all Darug people, that we have no connection. But we can obviously prove it and do the work here within the Sydney region.
Now, is Darug people one of the 300 countries in Australia? Is that?
And that's only roughly. how many countries there is. You know, some people will break them right down to clan or groups and say there's over 800 countries within Australia. So, you know, and in my language, I say Warami. So Warami is a greeting, it's hello, you know. But we're just starting to bring back our language. My wife is a linguist. She's done her master's in language. She speaks with a lot of other people around the country and immerses herself in our languages and is bringing a lot back because there was very few speakers left. And there was only a handful of Darug people really left from our ancestors where we all come from. And so even language was forbidden to be spoken within the Sydney region. You could be put into prison by the English ceremony. So we lost quite a lot. And I think, you know, further out west and other places, we're like 100 years ahead, well, from the dispossession than a lot of other people. But because there's so much money in Sydney, we have a lot of people from different countries who are cosmetically more blacker than I am. And one of the big problems we face is with Metro and Darabin Land Council, and this is to take nothing away from them. And they're one of the I suppose, they own the most property within the Sydney region. And you know, there's people that are very cultural, like myself, that get very disheartened by other mob, because I don't know of any other Darug people that are in land councils. And they have the formal agreements and the formal say for Aboriginal people within Sydney from the government, but they actually deny all Darug people. We don't exist. We're not here anymore. So they're some of the problems we face. But then I work with Parramatta Council, Cumberland Council, Blacktown Council, Blue Mountain City Council. I am booked up months in ahead for my cultural presentations, my singing and language, my camps that you can look up on YouTube. With Macquarie University and Newcastle University. And we call that down at Yarramundi where we do our camps, we call our group YBG, and that's Yanana Budri Gumara in my language. And that means to walk with good spirit, to have patience, humility, and respect, not only for everyone, and that it includes everyone, but for Mother Earth, because Mother Earth gives us everything that we use on a daily basis, and we're not looking after her like we have done in the past, and what our responsibilities are for country, because as Aboriginal people, we only take what we need. We don't look at, you know, making huge amounts of money out of country. And, you know, sometimes there's different things now since colonization where we're doing cultural burning and tours and things like that, but we don't take in resources until they're all gone. That's not our Aboriginal way.
Something I recently learned is that Uluru is sort of one of the Earth's line or center or something, and this goes through places like Bali and Mounted Picchu, and it's sort of like Earth's sort of, I don't know what it is, but it's like a really holy place.
It's a very sacred place, and over here on the East Coast we have Mount Yenga that is similar to us for those purposes. Yeah, it's a very spiritual place. I won't go into any, you know, deeper ways of that, but it's a very, very spiritual place. I remember I was working with one of my brothers who's a Jewish rabbi, and he said to me one day, he says, oh, Lex, you know, Australia's never, and he's known me as an Aboriginal person. I've worked with him as a speaker with him, etc. And he said to me, oh, Lex, Australia's never had a religion. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I had to explain that our religion, we mightn't have a church or a mosque or a synagogue, but our church is country, is bush, is Nura. And all our rock engravings are either directional points or tell you where to go or where not to go, because we're strict men's areas and strict women's areas, and also family sites. But they're also teaching sites. They're like a big book that is like a spider web with our song lines all over Australia. And a lot of them have been ripped up and torn up and destroyed for, I suppose, progress and the way of life of our modern world. And we often talk about that we walk in two worlds. So we're still living with our culture, you know, and practicing our culture every day. But we also have to work in this worldly world.
And you know how, like, Australia's split up in average, you know, 300 different countries? Do those, is it like sectioned out, or is that pretty fluid? Because you talk, you know, there's traditional lands, there's men land, there's lands just for females. How does that all combine? Is it
Sections of
demonized?
land. There's certain sections of that land and over the landscape that are for women and for men, and that's all been down since time immemorial. Our boundaries are fluid with other countries. Like up here in the mountains, we share country with the Gundungurra or Gunungurra. And I can only speak for myself. Some people are very strict on borders. Some people are very, fluent, and when that's when I'm speaking with other people from other countries. But you've got to understand that since money and greed and so forth has been in this country for the last 250 years, you've got to remember, before 250 years ago, for thousands and thousands of years, Andy, there was no poor people. There was no homelessness. There was no orphans. There was no prisons. And there was even no nursing homes. We had a strict law, a strict way of living. We looked after Mother Earth, each other. We did have conflicts, but they were very few and far between. We shared ceremony together, many countries. A lot of our people were multilingual. They could speak, 12, 13, 14 languages. But, sign language was right in there as well. Message sticks for communicating. So I suppose I can only speak for myself where when it comes to, the division and stuff. But with greed and power and especially money in this country now, with our worldly world as I speak, there's a lot of competition over boundaries. There's where there's the most work. There's a lot of competition over, all sorts of things because people want to have that power and they want to have that money. And it's a very difficult place to live in, I suppose. If I was Wiradjuri or Gamilaroi and I lived way out west, I could actually afford to buy my own house. But because my country's in Sydney, it is way out of my reach. And it's very ironic that I do welcomes and smoking ceremonies every single week. And I hear politicians and people always saying, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. But I pay nearly $700 a week to pay rent to live on my own country. And then I have responsibilities for country with national parks, Blue Mountain City Council, where I do a lot of work for no for free, because it's my responsibility for country. So I think it's quite ironic at times.
Now, when the government says, this area is traditional lands and normal people can't go there, it's just for the Aboriginals, and if you go there, it's like very unlucky, you'll get cursed. Is that truly the Aboriginal land? Do the Aboriginals or the country own that piece of land, or do the government still own it?
Well, Andy, the government really don't own it. It's all Aboriginal land. Like I said, it's been stolen. There was never a treaty signed, never a war declared, no money ever exchanged hands, there was no contract. We never ceded our land. It was just taken. It was stolen. So I don't really, we say the government owns the land, but I don't believe we own anything. It's our mother. How can we own it? We belong to it. She is part of us. And it's our responsibility to look after her. But I don't believe we own it. I have to abide by the rules that they own it because they have more guns than I do. And they have bigger machinery and they have more power and they can lock me up. But if we went back to, the law that is the land of now in Australia, you get fines if you're speeding or if you're, doing something wrong and, that sort of law. Our law actually connected back to country. And part of our law is looking after country, looking after each other, being patient, being humble, being respectful, and always trying to work on being the best possible person you can be. Not continually to work to get lots of money to be the biggest and the best, because we didn't compete over food and housing. We competed to see who could throw the furthest boomerang or the furthest spear, or we're probably have a race to see who could make the best rope in a short amount of time, something like that. And there was many games like AFL come from an Indigenous game called Mangrook, with a possum skin ball. But we didn't compete over the fundamentals of life, food and housing. But now we do. So look at that worldly world and look at our world, and the laws are quite very different. And I'm only speaking very lightly on our law.
Now, is it possible to sort of go back to those old traditional laws and live in the traditional land, sort of live off the land? Like, these areas are protected, there's no roads, there's no it's your it's you guys, is that possible to go back to the old ways and live?
I don't believe there's certain places probably in Australia with mobs up in Yolngu country and stuff. Yes, they do live semi-traditional, But I don't think for our mob here it's not possible. But like, look at the bushfires we just had a few years ago. Okay. If we were doing more cultural burning and had the space to do that, which I am doing cultural burning with national parks, but only on a very minute area. If we had more Aboriginal people out on country as caretakers, so they didn't have to pay big high rents and live in the worldly world, the ones that chose to be caretakers for their own country, I think we'd have a far better outcome, and that they could live probably not traditional lives, but semi-traditional, where, you know, they would become healthier, live off bush foods and have a supplemented diet, you know, whether it be doing wood carving, weaving, but site protection, you know, cultural burning. We still use the modern tools and so forth with our worldly world, but I think there could be a better outcome if there was better co-management practices between the holistic of national parks and different councils throughout Australia.
Beautiful. So what's like the best outcome? Like how can, like what would your ideal solution be? Like, is it that, you know, Australia took your land, it's only fair for them to, you know, give certain people within your countries, you know, income to look after the lands and do the cultural burning and sort of give you guys enough so you guys could survive, but at the same time keep breeding and sharing the culture? Is that sort of the best route moving forward, or like what would be the ideal outcome?
I suppose there's possibilities with that, Andy. I would, you know, I don't necessarily want a free ride. I don't want a free house or a free car. And then that's a big misconception that people think that all Aboriginal people get a free house and a free car. No, not the case at all. I haven't had anything for free. Oh, sorry, I get a little bit of assistance with my dental, but nothing big. Only if I've got a really big hole or it needs to be pulled out. I can't get my teeth cleaned or braces or anything like that. A lot of those people within other countries, there's a lot of mining going on, and that's where they get looked after with cars and things like that, because and they've, you know, I suppose haven't been fractured or displaced to the degree that us Sydney mob have, and that's where they get, you know, I suppose paid off in a sense with certain things. And that's only from my point of view, and I'm not putting anything down on those fellas, you know, because there's, you know, they're mining some of their country and taking things from their country. So they must have to be, what's the word for it?
Compensated.
Yeah, compensated for that type of thing. But I think, you know, if we could perform our responsibilities here on country without the cost of living being so high, we'd be able to do it on a far better and a bigger scale. And like I said, I don't want nothing for nothing, but, you know, make it more fair. I'd make it more fair for everybody, you know. To buy a house in my own country up here in the Blue Mountains is, be very lucky to get anything under $1 million, you know.
Is there like no government council positions where you guys get paid to literally look after the traditional lands, share about the country? Aren't there like government positions? Because I used to work in the Bankstown Youth Committee, and there were social workers that were just everyday people that help kids in the community. Are there roles like that for you?
No. Blue Mountains, in the Blue Mountains with national parks, they have roles, and they have Indigenous roles to look after country, but they're very stretched. They're stretched very thin. A lot of them aren't traditional custodians. But we get paid by national parks and the councils, et cetera, to do consultancy work, to do smokings and welcomes, et cetera. But their funding only reaches a small amount, I suppose, for what they're allowed to spend on that type of thing. That's why, like with my own organisation, YBG, Yanana Budri Gumara, we go for grants. We've had environmental grants. We're going for more grants. So that enables us to perform our responsibilities and hopefully train up a lot of more of our young people, which is my dream, to put them in those roles and to teach them more about country and culture.
Perfect segue. Tell me about the current generation of Aboriginal kids. What are they, just like normal kids nowadays, just going to the public school system?
And a lot of our children are growing up very urban. They haven't seen much country. They don't know a lot about our culture. They might hear it from an uncle or an aunt, but we get so caught up with making the dollar. And I know a lot of my brothers and sisters, they don't do any cultural work. They're working in normal jobs, in real estate agents and agencies and all sorts of places. You know, there's doctors, there's nurses, there's just like anyone else. They're working in those roles to be able to pay, you know, rent or mortgages. And, you know, they have busy life with kids going to schools and so forth. That's the difficulty. So I work for an organization and where you popped into, Andy, which is called ACRC, Aboriginal Cultural Resource Centre. And we look after elders, the youth. We have early intervention to, you know, make sure some of our young people don't get into trouble, that we're leading them on the right path, homework programs, all sorts of things like that. But for instance, we've been in a building for nearly 30 years that's owned by DCJ, Department of Community Justice. And there was a story, if you look it up on the ABC just last week, that we're looking at getting evicted. We're one of the most visited places in Australia with the Three Sisters, or we actually call it the Seven Sisters up here in the Blue Mountains. And we look like we're getting evicted. And that's the segue where we're teaching our youth and we're engaging with them, with our high schools, with our public schools, with some of our Steiner schools, our preschools, etc. We have play group with a lot of our young families. So there's just some of the problems that we're facing, Andy, and that's just in the Blue Mountains and it's all over the country.
No, I think I can totally relate with that feeling of working for the dollar, trying to get a bigger house, trying to get nice things, and constantly in this rat race. But isn't this a problem that literally everyone in the world is going through? Like, everyone's working for the dollar, everyone's stuck into the 9 to 5, and it's just not the Aboriginals.
No, exactly. Exactly. But when you get asked to do a welcome to country and a smoky, and you hear day in, day out, always was, always will be Aboriginal land, and you thank everyone and you smile and you shake hands with the minister or the premier or, you know, even the, I've worked even with the governor of New South Wales. And then they all say the same thing. But then you go home and you're paying a landlord a lot of rent and you know that your country's been stolen. And it's very hard at times, you know? When you just want to do culture and teach some of the young fellas and just be and do. I don't necessarily need a big flash house or the better and the biggest fastest thing, but you know, it comes back to that responsibility that you want to do for country and for the future youth, for instance. Like the shed that I have down here in Wentworth Falls, I've been very fortunate enough for the Blue Mountain City Council to give me a contract for 4 years, Andy. But it took me 2 years to get it. And it was an old RFS shed that hasn't been used in 30 years, council owned. RFS used to just store all their broken stuff here. And I've been dreaming of this for about 10 years. Everything in here was close to about $30,000 or $40,000 worth of equipment that I've gathered and scraped and saved up for over the last 10 years. And this has been my dream for the youth, but not only our local Indigenous youth, our local, you know, Darug, Gunungurra and all young fellas from different mobs. This is my dream for everyone. Everyone can come here and learn culture. And like I said, there'll be a dance circle, weaving, woodworking. I'm an ex-chef, so there's going to be little cooking classes and we're even going to do a little bit of forge work, but somewhere where those kids can be and learn culture in a safe, secure environment. And there's been nothing like this in the mountains before.
Now, would it be bad, let's say in the next, say, 200 years, a similar way it's like Japan, where most of the Japanese have lost their culture, it's modern, it's a 9 to 5 rat race, everyone's working, but then there's that small community where, you know, they still dress in the traditional robes and they learn about the traditional Japanese culture through school as they grow up, but majority of the country is in suits and working at a job. Is that seems to be happening everywhere, and it's probably going to happen in Australia most likely. Is that a bad thing, or do you want more culture?
No, we want more culture, and there's a big there's a big surge of people wanting to learn our culture here in Sydney. I wish I could clone myself. I'm so busy, and I do a lot of volunteer work, but I also do a lot of paid work. And I've actually just stopped going off the mountains because I'm so busy here in the mountains, and there's not many people that are down there doing a lot of work in Sydney. We've only got a rough, you know, probably roughly around, I don't know, maybe between a dozen and 20, but I only know a couple of guys that are wood carving, etc., that are showing people how to make rope, you know, our traditional tools, boomerangs, spears, coulomans, you know, just doing that work. There's only a handful of us doing it. So, but there's definitely a big call for it. And we've been doing, you know, lots of, you know, little clips for schools and a lot of teaching. I've had my own radio program up here for a while at Blue Mountains, RBM, and I'm ready to go back there in the dist in the not too fi near future. But just educating people on culture, and people just love to learn it. And so I don't think it's going to go the same as Singapore, maybe. Is that what you said, Singapore or Japan? So yeah, I don't think it's, well, I hope not. Because I just see, I have young people come up to me at 13 and 14 and saying, "Uncle Legs, you remember you taught me when I was 4 years old, and I've still got that set of clapsticks that you made me," and the excitement, and that happens all the time. So that excitement is really great to see, and people are proud to be Indigenous and proud to be connected to country, and that's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. But with the stolen generation, like my auntie, she passed away a couple of years ago, but she was 83 before she admitted to anyone that she was Aboriginal. And she was pale skin, because that was the, you didn't tell anyone you're Aboriginal because of the stolen generation. You told people you're Aboriginal, and if you're pale skin, you got away with being just normal and blended in with the crowd. But if you're Aboriginal and they knew, they'd come and take your kids away. That was just the way it was, you know? And that's why we haven't had a big voice, you know, probably 30, 40 years ago with a lot of our aunties and uncles here in Sydney. You know, there was a big voice in Redfern and the land councils and stuff, but they're all from different mobs. They all come into Sydney. Our mob, the majority of us are all very pale skin, etc., because we were the first contacted by the English. You know, people forget that. They look at me and I'm too white to be black and too black to be white at times. You know, I'm in the middle. I've got thick skin. You know, they call me Teflon. I just let it all roll off. There's a big thing within our communities, and it happens all around the world. I was talking to some Kalahari Bushmen a couple of years ago when I was over in South Africa, and we're having a big conversation about lateral violence. And people say, "Well, what's lateral violence, Lex?" I said, "Well, lateral violence is when people have been so dispossessed from their communities and culture and their country that they turn upon themselves, especially when money and greed and power come into it. And they turn upon themselves." So I, you know, for me, in our communities, you know, and especially in Sydney, I get attacked every 3 to 4 months. Someone trying to bring me down, someone trying to make something up about me. But I just keep forging ahead because I believe in our culture and believe in continuing our culture. Our culture's not dead. It's not extinct. We're still going very strongly and getting stronger by the day, especially Dharug people.
What do you think is currently the biggest sort of pain or struggle within the Aboriginal culture throughout Australia at the moment?
I can't speak for everyone, brother. I cannot speak for everyone. But there's, you know, there's lots of things. I reckon the biggest thing is get rid of all the politicians and start again. You know, from our perspective and just culturally, for them to be fighting and carrying on and running each other down like that is just so disgraceful. You know, I see it, I'm seeing it every day now because of, you know, the elections coming up, and you know, they've even got ads actually running down the opposition. Culturally, you're not to do that. You know, that's just not the right thing to do.
That makes sense.
It's not being respectful at all.
One thing I was pretty surprised was I heard a story from a fellow American how they went to New Zealand, they let their kids go to school, and they were surprised how in primary school we're taught about the history, how Australians invaded Australia with the convicts, and how we took over the land, and how we killed Aboriginals, and it was not right and fair. And I remember learning all that at a very, very young age. And that's something definitely not taught in America. Then they don't talk about how the Americans took over the original sort of landowners, the American Indians, I guess that's what they call. So I was pretty, and I'm pretty like happy that everyone's learned this from a very, very young age.
Yeah, it's happened all around the world, and I think, you know, it'd be great if we could have some sort of acknowledgement of that. You know, Kevin Rudd acknowledge the, you know, the stolen generation, etc., which was beautiful. And I've still got aunties that cry at that speech, etc. I just like it to be fairer for everyone, and really look, especially the politicians, and don't look at what you drag out of this country, because it's there's stories, there's song, there's dance, there's so much connected to this country. They can't just keep taking, you know, coal mining and gold mining and opal mining and all. It's all taking from mother, you know, and it's all for, you know, greed. We're not going to be eat. We're not. Our future generations aren't going to be able to eat that greed, all that money. You know, we need to start looking after country appropriately, not locking national parks up and you can't even pick up a stick. You know, we had cultural ceremonies within that country for thousands of years. Our old people had campfires. They were burning country. They were looking after country with cool burns, reducing that fuel load. There's all those sort of things we have to get back to, I believe. Because we our responsibility is for country and for our future generations, you know.
Interesting. So with all the backburning that sort of the government does at the moment on a large scale, are they doing the right thing? Is it done wrong, or do they know what they're doing?
They're doing it wrong, because there's a lot of people out there that I've worked with National Parks and RFS, and they do an absolutely magnificent job, and that's how they've been taught. But you've got to remember, they've got time constraints and money and different levels of power within those organisations. They're not coming from a, I suppose, a holistic point of view, from the same as we're coming from country, learning that country, really being with that country. And they do, a lot of those people really do know that country. So, you know, if there's any RFS and National Parks fellas out there, I'm not trying to say you don't know country, but I'm talking on a whole, and then, you know, being on country all the time, you know, burning that little section over there and that little section, not lighting it all up in one hit. But, you know, they're doing asset protection and doing the best they can. And they have time constraints, and there's lots and money constraints. So when they go out and do a backburn or a HR hazard reduction, you know, they might only have a small window of time to do it, and the money. And it costs a lot of money. And they're working with budgets and funding, and, you know, it's a that they're in a very difficult position, and especially the fieldies and those fellas that are out on country, because there's a lot of fellas in high level situations that are sitting in offices telling those fellas what to do and controlling them. And that's I suppose that's the way it's got to be, but they could have more, I suppose, co-management plans with local Indigenous people, and I think, and start looking into cultural burning and the way we do things. Farther to deeper, and they are anyway. They are looking at our local national parks up here are absolutely wonderful with us.
How do you sort of educate, 25 million people in Australia to look after the land, to trust the land, to learn all these traditional ways and sort of do these traditional things when we sort of live in this modern world and everyone is chasing power and that's sort of how everyone's raised. Like, how do we go back and do we need to go back?
I don't think we need to go back, but we can learn to actually be far more respectful in a different manner. So you come into Australia and you get your citizenship award at Blacktown or in Parramatta. I've done heaps of them. Okay. I do a welcome, I sing in language. They see me for about 8 minutes. That's all they get. So when I go on a job site, I've got to have an induction. They've got to tell me all the safety rules and where the toilets are. In case there's a fire, you have to meet here. Or if I do a, you know, cultural burning practice with National Parks, or, you know, we were doing a bush trail site visit or anything like that, there's an induction. There's a JSA, job safety analysis. And why don't we have an induction for every new person that comes into Australia? Why don't we have an induction on the aeroplanes? Give them a brief history of Australia. Tell them the truth. Tell them to respect mother. Tell them to look after mother. Well, not tell them, but just ask them politely and respectfully. Have a few people from different countries and say, hey, not all Aboriginal people are the same. Have a handful, like five, you know, fellas from Yolngu country that are almost black blue, fellas that are down the coast that are just lightly tan, some fellas out Dubbo that are darker. Then we got fellas that are pale skin. We all come in all shapes, colours, and sizes now. You know, there's Asian communities and stuff that have mixed with our mold. You know, we've got black fellas that look like they're from China or Japan, but they're still black fellas as well. Things have changed since colonization, and we have to realize that. But I suppose if we all come together and start thinking about, you know, Mother Earth as Mother Earth and as our mother, and respect her how she should be respected, I think that would be a far better outcome instead of just looking at it as a resource to take from.
Interesting. So yesterday I was invited to do Bikram yoga, and the couple that invited me, they just came back from Bali and they just did yoga for like 30 days. And Mark was telling me how in Bali they learned to, their God is the land. He learned to feel the energy from the land, and that sort of, you know, in our culture we sort of pray to Buddha, we pray to sort of family and all those things, but in Bali they were taught to pray and look up to the land. And that's something really familiar on what you just shared.
So many cultures around the world are like that, Andy. They honor the land, because you think about and how we see it, our mother gives us everything. This computer we're talking on, mother gave us this. My iPhone, mother gave us this. When I speak to children in the classrooms and that, I say, name me one thing in this room that doesn't come from Mother Earth. I always get moon rocks. I said, show me your moon rocks. Where's your moon rocks, buddy? And they try to tell me, oh, this chair doesn't come from Mother Earth. I said, where do we get it from? Pluto, Saturn? You know, do we get it from Mars? You know, there's not an Apple store up in the moon where we get our iPhones from. Everything from some form or another comes from Mother Earth. And it's how we dispose of our things and how we look after her and how we care for her. Because contrary to popular belief, we really don't own her. We belong to her. You know, many Aboriginal cultures all around Australia will say traditional owners, and that is the right way of speaking when we're speaking with local governments and that, because they have this perception that we own it. But for me, and when I'm only speaking for myself, I prefer to say traditional custodians. But I get told that I'm a traditional owner, and I go with it because I'm speaking with people that don't see any other way. They don't see it as a custodianship. They see it as owning it. You know, that's my. When you pick up a leaf or a little handful of dust and just flick it in the air, that's your life compared to how old Mother Earth is. So how can you own her?
As you're talking about that, like, I realize, like, even us, we humans come from the land, sort of. Like, when we die, we decompose, we come back into the land, and, you know, like, we
Well, it's that whole circle, Andy. It's we believe we go back to the sky country in Dharug culture. And when you see a shooting star in Sydney, you see that's a spirit baby being released from the sky country. And that spirit baby will go and sit in a big old tree for a short period of time, and a woman will conceive. So there's those circles. You know, we come from the land. We go back to the land. We are part of Father Sky, Biami, and Mother Earth, Pamawiyunga. And it's all part of it. It's all that circle. You know, that kangaroo, he goes back to the grass. He eats the grass. We eat the kangaroo. We gather the honey from the sugar bag, from the bees. It's all connected. And we all have to respect those things. And when we kill an animal, we try to use as much as we can of that animal. And we do. We even have special songs to sing them home to the sky country. You know, we don't want them to go on through unnecessary pain or suffering. We don't kill for sport, for the sake of killing. You know? We don't gather every yam or every bush tucker thing that we find in the bush and take it all for greed. And there's stories about that and carved in rock about not being greedy, about being respectful, about being humble, and especially about sharing.
One thing that still amazes me to this day was all those stories and all those drawings of the rainbow snake, that whole story and all the caves and all the finger paintings. Like, it's this like massive, beautiful sort of cultural thing that's all around it, and sort of all the different countries sort of have in
all different parts of those stories, and those stories all connect up and are part of it as a whole. It's pretty special, and for me especially, I'm still learning on a day-to-day basis, because a lot of our culture within here in Sydney was taken away from us. And I had to search and sit with lots of elders and just think and believe that our old fellows are around us all the time, and talk to them, our ancestors, and be humble and respectful, and things come to you.
One thing that sort of still amazes me, I don't know if it's good enough, but I went to two different primary school, high schools, different council sort of meetings, and when we go to assembly, we always sort of thank the traditional custodians of the land, and they sort of name the country that Parramatta High School was on, Yagoona Public School was on, and it's sort of a common thing that we a lot of schools and assemblies still start with.
Yeah, I suppose it is beautiful that they do that and they acknowledge the Aboriginal people, they acknowledge the traditional custodians, all the traditional owners. But imagine, Andy, if I steal your car off you and I stand up once a year and I tell everyone, I'm acknowledging Andy May for looking after this car for 5 years before I stole it, because I've really looked after it really well and it hasn't got a lot of miles on it. And I really thank Andy May for looking after the car that I stole off him. Thanks, buddy. So I love it that all the schools and governments and councils acknowledge our mob, but it's hard to swallow sometimes when you just know they're ticking a box that they have to do it, or they feel they have to do it. I know even just with me talking might make a lot of people upset out there, but this is reality. If we could sit down, if I didn't have to run all over the mountains or even go off the mountains for a lot of work, I would seriously be out on country looking after country and trying to get more cultural burning programs up and running, site visits, picking up rubbish, which I do anyway, but chasing up that worldly world. But then to get more education out there with the schools and the preschools is very, very important.
I don't know if you've watched this movie, but it's like a movie of a girl that I think she's American and she has a camel and she starts in Uluru and she travels all the way to the coast and goes up to Darwin. And the movie's pretty beautiful and how she meets elders that help her go through traditional land so she doesn't have to go all the way around. And she really, like, she respects that and she doesn't kill the kangaroo like that. Tell me about that story.
Well, I don't know a lot about the story. I've seen the movie, but that's the beautiful thing about our culture. Our old people, when you come into their country and traditionally, and from what are my teachings, that you were their responsibility. They had to look after you. But whether you were welcomed in or not, that was the difference too. Those old people see right inside you and see if you're humble or you're there to make trouble or you're there to take, but it was their responsibility to share, and that's beautiful story of how our old people looked after and how they were gracious to newcomers into our country. And that's exactly what happened when the English got here. There's different stories of such a Pemulwuy and Skeeto and Ngarrabee, all having, that resistance against the English for certain reasons. But there was good reasons for that. But a lot of our people were very gracious and humbling and welcoming a lot of those newcomers in, until, I suppose the resistance started when they seen the destruction of country and what was happening, and in a very short space of time.
Most definitely. And in that movie, like, how does one become an elder and they're allowed to go on the traditional lands and bring people? Is it sort of a rite of passage? Is it like a community? How does that work?
It's levels of knowledge, and different communities. It's all different, but there's nothing for to see a young person that's classified as an elder or very wise. You don't have to be old, but that is a misconception within our communities, in urban areas, that you've got to be. Once you're old, you're an elder. I've met many people. I'm an elder, but they don't seem to act like an elder at times. And that's not to take anything away from them, but I believe you've got to be humble, understanding, respectful, like I talked about, not judgmental, always having a listening ear, and be there for the young people, not perpetrate lateral violence, not rerunning people down, not be part of that gossip wheel. But that's the unfortunate thing when I talked about lateral violence that happens within our mobs, unfortunately.
Now, if you're a younger Aboriginal and you're not an elder, are you allowed to go into the traditional lands on your own?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I can't speak for other countries, Andy. I can't speak for other countries, and things have changed so much here in Sydney. If you're part of that country and it's your traditional lands, I wouldn't see a problem why you wouldn't be allowed to go and visit home and be there. But there's certain places you can and can't go. You know, there's if you haven't been through a traditional ceremony, for instance, and there's strict men's areas or strict women's areas, you wouldn't be allowed to go to them, no.
Now, when I was in the two primary schools I went to, I remember Yaguna Public School had like 2 to 3 Aboriginals, and when I went to Blackcell Street Public School, there was 2 or 3. So it was sort of small amounts, you know, it'll be 2 or 3 out of, you know, 600 students. So are you looking at sort of each country having 10, 20 members left in each country?
Oh, no, a lot more. Some smaller countries possibly that low, but yeah, we've got hundreds of Darug people here, if not thousands. Wiradjuri is a very big country, which is over in Lithgow. Dharawal country is, which is down Campbelltown way. I don't know a lot of Dharawal people, but I know there's Dharawal people down there. So yeah, those people would have to speak for their own countries, and you'd have to do a census or something, Andy, because no, but I don't think it's that low in many of our countries, no.
When you're sort of raised up in this sort of time, most people won't stay in their country. Most people would go to Sydney, go to the city, get a job, work in one of those
buildings. They have to, because their traditional ways and traditional lifestyle has been disrupted to such an extent that they can't live traditionally. They can't survive. So they have to come where the money is or where the services are. And there's a whole gamut of things wrong with the way this country is. Sugar, tea, flour, all that stuff that was brought into the country. We've got the highest rate of diabetes, heart disease. The list goes on, Andy, because our people haven't been used to those types of foods for thousands and thousands of years, and all of a sudden they were brought in. Especially alcohol can be a big problem, and smoking, drugs, but every community deals with them. But we have poor health outcomes in some of our communities that are, well, most of my communities we have poor outcomes, but we you know, that's why we have services like there's a place down in Richmond called Marana, ACRC up here in the Blue Mountains, you know, there's centres all over the country that look after our mob and have those services for NDIS and transport and early intervention, you know, all that sort of stuff. But we need more support from the government. And like I said, just in our situation here in the Blue Mountains, we look like we would be losing the only little building that we have. We're down to one sort of main dining room and a little kitchen. And dining room, I say, well, can fit about 10 people at a squeeze, and 2 small offices to service the whole Blue Mountains. And you went there. That's all we have.
Was it bigger before, or has it kept getting smaller?
We had the whole building, and unfortunately one of our previous managers gave some of the parts of that building away to other organisations, and it's owned by DCJ, and yeah, we're looking at all getting evicted because they don't want to be landlords anymore.
Wow.
And that's basis, but you can look that up on ABC, that story, and there's a whole story on it, Andy.
Now, so that means the owners, they're not part of the council, it's a private land.
Okay. Department of Community and Justice, that's the government.
Okay, wow, and they're kicking you guys out.
It looks that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, one, with transport, with city hubs, with cars and jobs, does that mean different people are living in different countries? Like in Blue Mountains, there'll be a lot more than Darug people?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Lots of people. Most of them are not Darug.
And does that mess things up, or is that normal? That's like...
Oh, I suppose to a degree, but some of these people have lived here all their lives. That's all part of the stolen generation and being fragmented and dispossessed from your own country. So we're very accepting of other mob, but it is difficult at times, like I say, with the lateral violence and so forth. And some of our mob, they get frightened that they don't know a lot of their own culture, you know. So there's this resentment, but there's a lot of trauma within our mobs. You know, they talk about our mobs, you know, and our people have transgenerational traumas. We carry our traumas from our ancestors, you know, and that still isn't healed, and there's still not a strong pathway forward with that.
Tell me about the traumas. Is it like a fear of being taken, a fear of sort of becoming more pale, a fear of just losing your culture completely and not knowing who you are?
I think a lot of, well, when I talk about transgenerational traumas, just traumas from our old people, I suppose, is just like anyone else would face, it went through war and dispossession and famine and, you know, being told that you're not allowed to speak your language. All right. So it's like I talk to people and say, well, what if I just come into your house? Right. You're not allowed to live in here anymore. You're not allowed to eat the food that you're eating now. You're not allowed to speak the language that you speak in or sing your songs or even practice any of your spiritual beliefs because we're going to put you in prison. And I get out of your house because I'm going to live in your house. And you go and forage and do whatever you want to find food because I own your house now. I'm driving your car. And I might invite you to a meeting once a year and I'll tell you what I'm doing with your house. But you're not allowed to live in it anymore. You're not allowed to practice any of your culture or your beliefs. Does that make sense, Andy?
That totally makes sense, and I think
So there's those traumas that my old people experience. So I can't explain what trauma I might be still feeling or inherited, but I know it's there. And people have a lot stronger of those traumas than I, especially with stolen generation and stuff, you know. I see a black car come down the road. They're all the kids are running hide, and aunties are trying to hide kids in the bush and in water tanks and, you know, horrible things. Horrible. But these men from the government are to come and steal you away from your parents and your aunties and your grandparents because they perceive and they think that you can't look after them. But that was all part of a simulation and wiping the plan to wipe Aboriginal people out. And that would be justifying them stealing the land if there was no one to tell the truth about it.
I think as you were talking about that, I really thought about it, and I think you're right because, my mum, she escaped from Vietnam, went on a boat, ended up in Indonesia, came to Australia. She had to escape from a communist country, and I think, as a Vietnamese, like I am more cautious. I don't want to overstep, my boundaries. I feel like I've been given an opportunity to live in a free country, so I don't speak out loud and I am more sort of submissive, and these are little subconscious things that came from my parents and it's now into me and I'm figuring these things out, and it sort of will obviously be less and less as the generation goes on, but it does get passed on.
There you go, and that's your own question.
So I guess tell me about where does majority of your time go to now, Lex?
Preschools, I have puppets, I play ukulele, I sing in language, I consult with national parks, Blue Mountain City Council, I run camps at Yarramundi to do cultural burning. I suppose my work is just so different from day to day. Tomorrow I'm moving an elder out of her flat to move to another place with another young fella. I'm talking with you today to do a podcast. I spoke, I can't remember all the acronyms, but this morning I spoke about all of the, you know, homophobia, transphobia. You know, it was the International Day Against Those Things. I spoke at a conference this morning about that, and I told a story, sung songs, done a demonstration of rope making, that when we work together, we're far stronger. So my day just changes from day to day. You know, I could be at a funeral next week doing a smoking ceremony and seeing that person home to Sky Country, whether it's male or female. And, you know, those sort of days, I'll give an example. I don't believe, for me culturally, and they're on my country and they're going home to the Sky Country, I don't charge for funerals. So that day is just donated to whoever that person is going home to the Sky Country. I donate that day to them and to their family.
I guess right now your main goal is to sort of share as much as possible. Is that correct?
I'm out there sharing culture, showing them about ochre, glue that we get from the bush, how to make a coulomb and a carrying dish, a digging stick, how to make rope out of bark. And I see the kids and even the adults, they come down and they do cultural work with me. They get so excited. They get so excited. They go, wow, I was walking past that plant and I never knew that plant could offer so much. You know, but then I educate. We only take what we need. You know, you don't take everything. Don't be greedy. Leave something there for others and for the generation regeneration. And you know, don't take a heap of things with seeds off them just because you want them. You see that rock on the ground? It's not yours to take. And do you need it? No, I want it. But no, you don't want it. Leave it there. It's like opals. Opals are very expensive. Are you familiar with opals, the rocks, Andy?
It's a teal color. It's shiny. It's
And they all go in rings and they make pendants out of them. Well, I've heard the old stories. It's the rainbow serpent, Wawe. That's as rainbow serpent traveled through country and shed its skin a few times. That's opals. That's Wawe's, that rainbow serpent story. That's the shedding of that snake's skin. That's just a part of that story, but it was there. We knew your old fellas knew there was gold in the ground, knew there was uranium in the ground. They didn't touch it. It's all part of bigger stories. And they're not my stories to tell, but do you know what I mean? So if it's there, you don't have to take it. It's not yours. If you need it, that's a different matter. If you need to make a stone axe, you grab that stone, you pay respects to country, you pay respects to the old people, and you use that.
Have you thought about sort of using social media, using stuff like TikTok? And I know you're really busy, but creating like these 60-second clips, 30-second clips once a day, like I think people would love, it's basically amplifying what you
Yeah,
want to
you come
share.
up for me, Andy. You come up on a weekend, we'll do a heap of them because I've got puppets and I sing in language and all sorts of things. But I have trouble just with my emails. I didn't do very well at school. I just wanted to be out bush and in the ocean because I grew up in Eden and I couldn't pay attention. It wasn't the way I learned. So I have problems with my emails and computer work, and that gives me headaches, let alone putting something up on TikTok. I have wanted to do stuff with my puppets and educate and sing, and they're very life-size, lifelike puppets. If you look up Yarramundi Kids, that was my auntie, she's in the Sky Country now. But if you look up Yarramundi Kids, she was the one that trained me. And we were trained by a lady who was trained by Jim Henson, who invented the Muppets. You know, so and they're a very good medium for teaching culture and connecting with the children when I'm out in preschools and high schools, and I've even used the puppets in corporate situations in the city, just talking about sharing and looking after one another and being kind.
Is it possible, like, as you sort of build this cultural center, like, have these kids that are growing up and have them hang around, have them become apprentices and help you with all this social media, help you with your emails, and have like a small group?
Well, that's what I'm aiming at, Andy, but I'm aiming at such a, even a bigger dream. So I want to start up an organization called Shadow Rangers, and they're going to do the work that, you know, the councils and national parks haven't got time to do, or we can work in collaboration and co-management with them and help them, and then that in turn will help us to look after country and to perform the responsibilities. Because too often or not, I've seen our people get angry at organizations and get, you know, up in arms about things, and they're not doing this, they're not doing that. And I just say, yep, you've probably got a very good valid point, but for me, it doesn't work. I believe that you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar, and we need to all work together for the betterment of country and for our future generations. And I believe we're planting trees that we ourselves won't sit in the shade of. And I know someone else famous than me said that, and I'm not famous, but I can't remember that person to quote them. So if someone hits up, let me know.
I think that Shadow Ranger idea would work. Like having a group of these, because like you've figured it out yourself, Lex. You have figured out how to get speaking arrangements, culture tours, create events, and you get paid to do so. And you basically want to multiply you with other sort of young kids that want to do the exact same thing that you're doing, and with social media and the kids are just getting smarter, they'll be able to do it on a bigger scale and get more events and do more Zoom calls. And if you have more sort of Aboriginal kids working with you, it will just only grow.
So our place at Wentworth Falls, that's exactly what it's going to do. Teach them those basics about being humble, being respectful, being patient, and then send those fellas out, whether it's being a shadow ranger, whether it's just doing, well, they could be all under the shadow ranger banner, but go out and do a cultural talk at a preschool, because that fella mightn't be the type to want to get out and wield a chainsaw or do things in the bush or, you know, do cultural burning. But then you might have another person that wants to sing in language or wants to learn more language or wants to sit with the elders and do weaving and woodwork or just make artifacts. We want to make, and this is my dream, is having a space here for no matter what your aptitude, whether you're really good on computers or you just want to make a set of clapsticks or be a wood carver, you can do whatever you want, as little or as much as you want. But the only thing that they need to know is when they walk in through these doors, that they walk with Yana Noble Dringwamata, to walk with respect and patience and humility, not only for each other, not only for yourself, but for Mother Earth. If you're going to cause trouble and you want to fight or you want to, you know, compete and put other people down, you go outside the gate and come back in when you can have Yana Noble Dringwamata. We're all going to have our differences, but we sit around the fire and we discuss it with those attributes. If anyone else is trying to put another person down or try to stand over them, no, it's not our way. I don't see any future in that.
Yeah, as you're talking about all those different things, like I can see these kids getting, like people pay hundreds for traditional boomerangs, paintings, clapsticks, and you know, social media just sort of will blow that up. And then I think as time goes on, there will be ways to survive doing each one of those little things. Because as you said, there's no way for people can't survive in the bush anymore, but people can survive. You know, there's people who literally, they just travel all year round and they make money sharing them traveling. People can, and there's people who literally have content of them just doing these 24-hour survival challenges in the bush. And there are ways, but I think maybe the next generation really has what it takes with social media and how the world is now.
Yeah, well, we're doing it without, I'm sure like it could be on the money with the social media things, but you got to remember when we put ourselves out there on social media that we opens up a forum for people to attack us. There's a lot of people on social media, but it's not for me. I'm happy for the young fellas to do it, but it doesn't do it for me. But there's so many ways, like I've even found ways of making money out of weeds and making a lot of money out of weeds. There's a weed in Australia, I'm not going to say the name over this because I'm still working on it, but if there's any chemists out there that are listening to this or are really good with oil stills, they could contact me through ACRC, Aboriginal Cultural Resource Centre up in the Blue Mountains, because I'm trying to develop a team, because this is my dream too. And if we can extract the oil out of this certain weed, and it's worth a lot of money, it's actually worth $870 a litre, and I'm working on it at the moment, and it will be eradicating a weed that is right throughout Australia. I don't know about throughout, right throughout the, you know, east of Australia. Is I'm hoping that if we have our young Indigenous people that stick through our organisation and the YBG group for a year and a half or a 2 year period, that if we're producing this product as, and it's got amazing healing properties, this product, that they become shareholders within the organisation, and then that becomes stronger and stronger for their self-determination to buy their first car, to put a deposit on a house or a unit, to have the tools and the self-determination and I suppose the tools to have your own little place. Now, like I said, I don't believe in owning it, but in this worldly world, you need to own something, or you need to belong to something and not be, because real estate agents and landlords, they have so much power over people where they can kick them out or I'm selling, and you know, people have to uproot their lives and move children from schools. And, you know, I think in the long run, we're going to be paying far too much money for, you know, mental health and therapists and all that sort of disruption that these things cause. And so I want to create a place where we can have far more self-determination and stability for our young people. And through this another leg of the process that I'll be doing through YBG, I'm hoping that this is going to be possible, Andy, and for them to have a better chance than I have.
That's beautiful. And I think you're right. Like what you're doing is you're setting up the foundation for the next generation. And yeah, like all this business acumen, like it's really hard for you to do it all on your own, and by the time it does get passed on to the next generation, you will be a bit older, and it's up to the next generation to really take on everything you teach them.
That's already starting, Andy. I've already got groups of young fellas. I run a boys group. I've got other teenagers that are right behind what we're doing here, and they're all part of it. And I have many, many organisations right throughout the Blue Mountains that are behind me, from, you know, local members to youth services, to mental health services, to even the hospital. You know, we have so much support for what we're doing and how we're conducting our culture and our learning up here.
That's so beautiful. Lex, where can people find more about what you're doing, learn more about your journey, and just basically learn more about everything you just shared today?
I suppose, yeah, contact us through ACRC, Aboriginal Cultural Resource Centre in the Blue Mountains, and just look us up, send us an email, and if you want to come down to the Gunya shed, because we walk in two worlds. So Gunya is like shelter in our language, and shed is just what it is. It's a shed. So I dual named it the Gunya shed. I suppose come and see me here and have a yarn, and if you want to help, come and help and be part of it. If you don't want to help and just want to learn culture, come and learn culture. But if you want to come and make trouble, stay away.
Beautiful. We'll link.
And I can't be more honest than that.
Beautiful. We'll link everything that you just mentioned in the description below. But yeah, thank you so much for your time today, Alex. I think I just love, you know, you do have this humble spirit from you, and you definitely do have that energy where you're constantly wanting to learn, and you're always curious, and you're combining all these stories, but then you also have this sort of you don't have this ego where you don't take you don't claim these stories as yours to tell, and you're really self-aware about that, and I'm really, yeah, I just love your energy, and thank you so much for sharing everything today.
Thanks, Andy, and I'm looking forward to you coming up to the shed and having a bit of yarn, because I actually want to talk to you more about the TikTok stuff and the YouTube stuff with the puppets, and maybe we could work in collaboration. That's French for share. No, it's my Lexi French. I made that up.
I'd love that. So yeah, that's another episode of the podcast. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode. If you made it this far, thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you guys next week with another episode. Peace.
Peace out.